My name is Jared, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Jackie and Debbie, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Julianne will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Julianne. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting for our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things you cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Wilbur will read the steps.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Wilbur, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. The 12 steps of AA. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching, fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of characters. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Julie will read the traditions.
Hello, I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority. A loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our primary our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity as a level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thank you. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Lisa L.
My name's Lisa and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank Melissa for asking me to speak tonight. It is an honor and a privilege, and she's a very good friend. And it's great to see her back here. And I'd like to thank Heidi for hosting me. She just does such a wonderful job and keeps up the traditions here at the Atlanta Group so well. And, you know, it's just a great thing. Okay, so in 10 minutes or less, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what happened, what it was like, and what it's like today. I was born in upstate New York. I'm the youngest of three. My parents are not alcoholics. My oldest brother and my middle sister are. And at a very young age, I started to experience, I guess what my older brother and sister started to experience, maybe their situations were not identical to mine, as how my doubts and fears started to be revealed to me. But I will say that we all definitely followed in suit. And I bringing them up from the rear as the little sister. And so, so at a very young age, I was happy-go-lucky, just kind of, you know, growing up and trying to be involved in different things as young children have a tendency to do. And I just realized I had a lot of extra energy on deck that, you know, just allowed me to be so involved. And in the midst of all that involvement in different clubs and groups and neighborhood kids and stuff, I just started to have this feeling of fear and doubt kind of come creeping in out of nowhere. It was just kind of like blindsided me, you know, and I just couldn't make heads or tails of it. And so that feeling just quickly kind of continued to be a part of my daily living in the midst of trying to have fun. In the midst of doing that, I started to kind of overcompensate on a daily basis with my dealing with family and friends and relatives and just even casual people that I would bump into. And I would probably do that in the form of overlaughing or you know, dominating a conversation or trying to control situations or just trying to always have the nicest whatever and always trying to just do the nicest, you know, thing or people please or whatever those ways that we start to develop this overcompensation type of, you know, attitudes and behaviors, which definitely started to rear their little head by the time I was in seventh grade, enough so that I became so uncomfortable in the midst of watching my brother and sister start, you know, suffering from alcoholism and this disease progress so rapidly like it did for them. And my brother is still drinking. My sister's 20 years, and I just turned 15 last month. But I will say that, you know, that fear and that doubt and that connection that I simply just wanted from talking to my fellow man, and just wasn't getting, you know, just trying to have a normal conversation with somebody and not really feeling like on the end of that conversation that just something was missing, you know. I didn't know if it was from you, and I didn't know if it was from me, and I just wanted to have a good time. So, you know, no amount of activity was, I guess, taking the place of that or distracting me long enough from those uncomfortable situations and feelings that I found myself in often and frequently, or frequently enough that I just couldn't, you know, run away from it any longer. Kind of like what happens when you stay sober long enough, you know? So as I saw my brother and my sister's disease progress and drive my parents absolutely crazy, I swore I would never start doing what they started to do, which was drink and use drugs. Basically, drugs was just kind of always around, but drinking was the main drug of choice. It was just easy, accessible. I was this tall when I was like 14, so I could, they weren't too concerned in upstate New York about, driving, drunk too much at that time, and if you were underage. So I could just kind of swoop down into any club and they would serve me, blah, blah, blah. And, that kind of started the whole situation. I started to go to clubs. I started to, feel like I didn't fit in. And, I started to feel like, really kind of isolated, I guess you might say. It started with that. It's a disease of progressive isolation. At least it was for me, and if I understand correctly, a couple people in the room too. And it just doesn't let up, And so I started to drink on a daily basis. Thank you so much. I started to drink on a daily basis, and I progressed, after a couple months of drinking beer, which I couldn't stand the taste of alcohol. The entire time I drank, I couldn't stand the taste of alcohol, but I just knew I needed to do something to get the job done. So what I started to do is I started to drink grain alcohol and Southern Comfort and Wild Turkey and Yukon Jack. And I would literally plug my nose and just drink it just to have that feeling of relief from the discomfort and the ill-at-ease feelings that I was having. And it seemed to do the trick, it just got me off and running. I was a completely changed person. You want to talk about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? I went from a goody-two-shoes type of young lady, taking piano lessons, being on the swim team, being on this club, writing for the newspaper, to complete, unadulterated, I don't care. I mean, I was training with Olympic training people for swimming and all this other stuff at like 4 a.m. before homeroom, like 3 hours of that stuff before homeroom. And all of a sudden, it just started to kind of like, okay, just, this is fine. And basically when it ended up happening after going on no dates in high school, because I was just really afraid of people, men and women, if I couldn't control a situation, it would just leave me feeling unleashed and unnerved, because I just couldn't handle that feeling. I didn't know how to walk through that feeling from point A to point B, and just mature and grow in those areas, And come to find out, people around me were doing this all the time, but I just kind of was always left there kind of scratching my head. Like, how did they just do that? How did they go on that date? How did they buy that dress and go to the dance? And through, continually just progressing in my disease, after about 10 years of drinking, I just hit a bottom. A boyfriend had broken up with me, which is usually the way I get to grow and learn and change and walk through those feelings. Walk through those feelings of discomfort yet one more time and try to learn from them, and to realize that I didn't have a problem. This is what happened. I realized I didn't have the problem. My brother had the problem, and I went to Al-Anon for 5 years and gave complete and utter lip service to that program. And then, but I did hear about the steps, and I did hear about the traditions, and I did hear about what it meant to take the actions to do right living, and get a life here in this program. After that sponsor said that she had given me everything she could, little did we know I was a dry drunk waiting to come into AA, because I was just basically kind of started hallucinating after my fourth year of being a dry drunk and having another relationship break up and going through audiovisual and praying for purification, because I just thought if, I could just pray for purification, I'd be fine. It was some light spiritual reading I was doing, right? And, I found myself starting to realize that I did have a problem, and I brought myself into a 30-day for an emotional problem. And the second day I was there, they could just hear the venom of this disease just, coming out of me, thank God. Someone was bright enough and intelligent enough there. They could just look at me and hear me and knew that that was just kind of like a alcohol problem maybe. And then they just kind of, after 30 days, suggested I go to a halfway and then a three-quarter way, believe it or not, which was news to me. I didn't even know they existed. And then after that, I was so blessed because it was completely steeped in this incredible, wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so lucky because I had a sponsor who right away, thanks again, got me up and running with those steps right away, took me right down that road, like so many incredible people in this meeting do and have done and continue to do. And then all those places I went to, which isn't everybody's story, it happens to be mine. You don't have to go to those places, but I happen to have gone to those, and because AA works great. And I've been to school, I've gotten my education, you know, and I'm working full time. I'm a wonderful, sober, active participant in life today. I have a wonderful job, and I have wonderful friends. And this life is really not to be missed. And it continues to get better a day at a time. We had a wonderful Saturday at the Bill Wilson dinner. Our very own Bonnie spoke, who did just a terrific job, and it's wonderful to be a part of it. Come back. This is the place. Take from Alcoholics Anonymous everything you can, and then you too can give back as well. It's a wonderful life. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next 10-minute speaker is Matt.
I'm Matt Littman, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank James McLean for asking me to speak. I want to thank Peggy and Van for starting this meeting. This meeting has changed my life. It's meant the world to me. And tonight I'm going to tell you a little bit about what's going on. First of all, again, I'm Matt Littman, and I'm an alcoholic, and I am a member of the Atlantic Group, very proudly. My sponsor's name is Rick. And my sobriety date is 9/19/04, and I am working on step 9, making amends in step 9 right now. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Take you back to like the late 70s, growing up, upper middle class family in Long Island, and I get awoken up in the middle of the night, and my father wakes me up, and he's like, "Come on, Matt, come on. Come downstairs," and I'm all of about 7 or 8 years old, and I get downstairs, and the music is pumping, and my parents and their friends are all over the place, and there's alcohol all over the place, and they are having the time of their lives, and my father turns to me and he says, "Matt, dance like John Travolta for everybody, Saturday Night Fever." So, you know, the music's going, you know, and I'm dancing away for them, and you know what? I look at them and they're partying with me and dancing with me, and I'm like, wow, I want that, you know? And I kept that memory with me until, you know, I got into my early teens, because as soon as somebody would ask me, "You want to come to a party?" I was like, yeah, you know, I'm there. My first time I actually succeeded in getting drunk, I was probably about 12 years old. I was in eighth grade, and I went to a keg party. And it wasn't Saturday Night Fever. It was more like Ozzy Osbourne and Black Sabbath. And, you know, and I drank like, you know, I was angry and listening to metal music. And I definitely succeeded. I got drunk and I puked, and I had to be carried home. But you know what? I was feeling good because I was with a party. I belonged and I fit in. Well, that story continues pretty much through my teens. You know, I was always looking for that next good time. I did whatever I had to do to get it, whether it was to cause trouble, to rob, to steal, whatever it took. I was going to have a great time, and I knew that whoever was with me was going to have a good time too. Well, I did that so much that I got in so much trouble that my parents were like, "You're out of here." They sent me to boarding school, and after getting thrown out of 2 boarding schools in the New York area, they sent me off to London. Growing up a Jewish kid from Long Island, going to boarding school outside of London, it was not a treat. It was not a benefit in my education. In fact, the first day I got there, you know, I was so into girls always, and at meeting girls and flirting with girls, and those of you who know me know that that's definitely true. I picked out the prettiest girl the first day I was there and went right over to her, and of course she was like receptive back to me. And I'm like, wow, this is great, you know? And sure enough, she was like the most popular guy's ex-girlfriend and a rugby player. So instantly, I had enemies. So not only being a Long Island Jewish kid, you know, everyone hated me from day one. And, you know, I went and I found the pubs. And in London, you could drink when you're 13, 14 years old. And I proceeded to get drunk and get in trouble. So much so that I hated it so much that I got thrown out. My mission accomplished as usual. You know, that story continues. Pretty much for the next 20 years, unfortunately, and it stopped being fun. You know, I hear that a lot, and that's definitely my message and my story. I couldn't have fun anymore, no matter how I tried, no matter how much I drank. And it was straight vodka, and it was, you know, I didn't even need ice cubes when I got to as bad as I was going. And it was alone. And I wasn't having fun anymore, and nobody was having fun with me. You know, people started saying to me, Matt, you really should get some help. You're really out of control. You're crazy. You're crazy. You're crazy. You're so crazy, you know. Well, I believed them. And, you know, after getting in trouble, whether it be with schools, police, the towns, the government, whatever it was, I finally succeeded in thinking I was crazy enough to go to a psych ward and a psychiatrist who, you know, basically told me, you know, you're an addict. And no matter what, all this anger and all this, everything you're doing is because you are an addict and you're an alcoholic. And I had no choice but to get better. But I was going to do it my way at first, you know. After getting through treatment and then continuing with drug and alcohol therapy, the therapist I was seeing, who had 18 years sober, told me that if I don't go to a meeting of AA, he's not going to treat me anymore. Because he could just see in my attitude the way I was going, and I was still, you know, drinking and, you know. So I went. Of course, I didn't go on the Upper East Side or anywhere where I lived. I didn't want anyone to know what I was doing or what was going on. And I ended up going to a meeting out on Long Island near my hometown, but not too close to my hometown. I went in. It was a Wednesday night. It was a step meeting. And there was some traction there. You know, people were nice to me. And I ended up kind of going a little bit, you know, and my therapist was happy, and I was like, you know, I was such a people pleaser, so I was like pleasing him, and, you know, I told my parents what I was doing, Mom and Dad, I'm going to stop drinking, I'm getting sober, you know, and I went to meetings, and I met a guy a few weeks in. I'm a salesman, I sell to big companies, and he gives me his card, and it says CFO, and it looked like a big company. I'm like, this would be my sponsor, you know, and then I could get his business too, you know. That's where my head was at. That continued for about 6 months, and I wasn't doing any work with this sponsor, and I was started to really slack on my meetings, and then all of a sudden I got invited to spring break in the Bahamas, and I'm like, I'm there, and I got there, and it was over. And I get into an elevator, and there's two really cute girls, and they're like, hey, what's up? Where are you going? And I'm like, where are you going? They're like, we're going to buy alcohol. And I'm like, all right, I'm with you. So sure enough, I went out, came back to New York, didn't tell anybody, came back to the meetings, everything was cool. And if anyone here in this room has ever lied about drinking and going to meetings, it's the worst pain known to man. I picked up the phone, finally, I felt like a fish out of water, I'm going to meetings, I'm still drinking, and my friend Eddie tells me, you gotta call my sponsor, his name's Rick. I called Rick, it was the scariest moment in my life, picking up the phone, he tells me to meet him in his apartment. I go, and for some reason, I don't know what it was, he had this presence over me. And I knew right away that he was no nonsense. And I am all about nonsense. So I knew that this was going to be a great fit. And you know what? We got into doing the work together right away. You know, he told me, read page 62, 63, 76, and I'm writing it all down. And you know what? I was going to be super sponsee. And you know, I read Bill's story, and then I wrote my story out for him, and I went to his apartment and read it to him. And you know what? He told me to call him at 8 a.m. I called him at 8 a.m. We got into the step work together. I started to feel a little bit better, and then we got into 4, and I started to feel worse. But you know what? We made an appointment to do step five. We went out to my house out east for the weekends, and we spent the weekend together. And I've never become more close to any human being in this world as I did that weekend. I started to feel better because I started to do the work. And my message to the newcomer tonight is just what I've said. It's get a sponsor. Get a sponsor you love. If you don't like the first one, it's okay. You can change and get a new one. Listen to what he or she says, because they're the guide. You know, I was told that when you go to a safari, you wouldn't go without a guide. So why would you do the steps without one? You know what? It's so true. So then I got through 4 and 5 and 6 and 7, and you know, I'm kind of balking a little bit with 8 and 9, but I'm praying a lot. I found God. I found God somewhere through my childhood, then forgot about it. But you know what? I realized that if I want to feel good and I want to get this work done and I want to get better, then I got to find God. And I did. And I pray. I wake up in the morning. I get down on my knees. I pray to God. And I'm very grateful. I used to complain all the time. I mean, there's so many of my friends in this room who know me. I used to call them up and be like, oh, my God, I hate this program so much. I hate my sponsor. You know, you're going through that period where you get off that pink cloud. But you know what? I don't complain anymore about anything. And if you found this room and you could do what I just told you tonight, the simple things, get the sponsor, do the work, get the program, you will get better and you will stop complaining and you will start to enjoy life. We have so much fun now. My friends in this room, we laugh all the time. We go away for the weekends together. We got other trips planned. This room has been so much to me. Thank you all for my sobriety. I love you. Thank you.
Board. And our main speaker tonight is Cookie.
Happy now?
Are you?
Hi.
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 I'm from Minnesota. We say hi a lot. Okay, I'm going to tell you the most important fact of my life. The most important fact of my life is my name is Cookie and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
And through the grace of God and the 12-step program of recovery from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink since October 25th, 1983. And that may not impress you, but it impresses the heck out of me. Okay. All right, so where am I going to start? I never know where I'm going to start. First, I want to thank Ava, my wonderful sponsee, well, whatever works, and her girls, because they have been so wonderful to me since I've been here, and it was just a thrill to hear Bonnie and be part of that. And I am a very, very grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in more ways than I could possibly ever explain to you, that I am honored to be here at my New York home group. And I say hello to you from my home group, which is in Hopkins, Minnesota. And it's called For Today, and it meets every day at noon. So you can never miss a meeting. We always have one for you. So if this day doesn't work, we have another. Please excuse me, I have to drink quite a bit of water. 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I stand here today because of Ava. If she hadn't bugged the absolute bejesus out of me to go to the doctor in her kind and gentle way. Go to the doctor! I would have not gotten there in time. And if I had not gotten there in time, they would have taken most of me away. So I had to have the back of my throat taken out. Smoking was not good to me. And I don't have any saliva, so it's kind of hard to talk. So if you'll please forgive me for drinking a lot while I'm talking, I would appreciate that. Okay, let me see. Where should I start? I was born a rich white child. Oh, I don't know. I just figured I'd start there. I was brought up in extremely privileged surroundings, and I was given everything I ever wanted. My parents told me I could do anything I wanted to do, and I could accomplish anything I wanted to accomplish. They loved me. They told me I was worthwhile. They said that, you know, you're just the best, honey. And I was an achiever, you know, and I was a figure skater and I was a horseback rider and I did all the right things because I wanted my parents to love me. And, you know, that's what I did. And I was a good kid. So it goes downhill from there. And the reason I say this, and I like to say this because a lot of people ask me to speak in different places because I was born a rich white child, but I don't say that to try to impress you, like, ha ha ha, I could impress a New Yorker. Not possible. But when I first came in, I would listen to people speak, and I'd be back there in the shoe section. Oh, that's what we call it in our group. It's full of slippers and loafers. And and I would listen, you know, and I'd listen. And when I was new, I listened for all the differences instead of the similarities. And there's a lot of them. You know, we can all have lots of differences if we look for them. But I would sit back there, and people would talk about these horrible stories. I mean, you know, some of our stories are just, oh, my God, you lived? And, you know, and shock treatments and in and out of hospitals and funny farms and all kinds of stuff. And I can remember thinking to myself when they spoke, I think, well, no wonder they drank. What's the matter with me? I was given everything. And I know something today. I know if I find a way to say that I'm different, I will find a way to die of the illness of alcoholism. Because alcoholism doesn't care where you come from. It doesn't care how much money you have or if you're rich or poor or anything else. If you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, you will die of the illness of alcoholism without treatment. And for me, I found that treatment in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's why I tell that piece, because there are other people out there like me that say, but I don't know if I belong here or not, you know, and I qualify, and I'll tell you how. It took me a long time and a lot of inventories to get to where I am now to be able to tell you the things I can tell you today. Certainly when I was new, I didn't know these things. You know, as you stay sober longer and longer, you become more and more honest. It's really depressing. And and you know, when I first came in here, I was only an alcoholic for like the last 5 years. And the longer I stay here, the longer back I find my alcoholism. You know? So then I was like, well, really, it was the last 10 years. And then it was like, well, the last 15, I really was badly. And then pretty soon it was when I picked up the first drink, I was an alcoholic. And if I stay here much longer, it's going to be in vitro. So anyway, so my girlfriend and I got together one time. We were talking about this after a meeting. And I'll tell you how alcoholism and how it appears in my life. My parents also, I grew up in a family that, like I said, was very privileged. My mother used to put on these wonderful parties, and they were a big deal. I mean, they were a big deal. We had a living room about this size, and we would, my mom would have people come in and decorate everything, and there'd be music and food, and it was all about, you know, just being beautiful and having a wonderful time. And this was exciting to me. I just thought this was like major fun. And I had to go around, and my parents taught me how to curtsy, and it's a really handy habit to have if you ever have to meet the queen. And so I'm ready. The prince is in town. I'm ready. I got my curtsy in place. So anyway, I go around and meet all these people and say hello and, you know, and da 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 da. And I would watch everybody, you know, because I'm a good watcher. And I'd watch them. And people would come in, and the men were all in tuxedos, and they were just all so handsome. You know, I love men in tuxedos. I have got to quit marrying them. And I would, I just watched them. This one lady came in, and you know how some people are more than other people? They're just more. She came in, and she had on this blue sequin dress. And this was, I'm not even going to tell you how long ago this was because it's too depressing. Anyway, so, anyway, she had this dress on, and it was on one shoulder. Ooh, racy. And it had blue sequins, and it started up here, and it was light blue, and it got darker, 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 and it was form-fitting, and she had a form to fit. And it sort of pooled around the bottom of her feet in this blue pool. And she was just gorgeous. And she had this great big huge hairdo. I still suffer from that. And she had this big long cigarette holder. you know, and it was back in the days in the big long cigarette holder, and it had little teeny blue rhinestones around the end, and I thought, oh, even that matches, it was so cute, and she had a little blue bag that hung from her thing, and her blue shoes, and she was just gorgeous, and the butler came by and asked her what she'd like to drink, and she said, I'll have a martini, just like that, I'll have a martini. I practiced that for a long time. Never did very good at it. Anyway, so she was gorgeous and pretty and more, just more than everybody else. And so the butler brought up the martini, and it was a V glass and had little blue bulbs on the bottom. Oh, and the glass matches her dress. I was so impressed. And so she's standing there, and she's got her big long cigarette holder, and she's got her martini glass, and she's gorgeous, and all the men are around her. You know, and I wanted what she had. Attention. I've always wanted attention. I used to go for good attention, then I tried bad attention. Now I'll take anything at all. You get to a certain age, you don't care anymore. And so yeah, the evening wore on, and my parents told me I had to go say goodnight to everybody, and at least I didn't have to hurt you again. And I went, I hid upstairs so I could watch people, and I was watching her because she was just way too fascinating. And it was later in the evening. And pretty soon she's standing there talking to these men, and she'd been dancing and everything. And now her martini's kind of going over here. And her cigarette ashes are kind of going over here. And her hair sort of got drunk. She was standing next to her husband, who was this gorgeous man, this tuxedo, and all of a sudden he sort of just swooped her up and took her out the door, and I went, oh, isn't that romantic? You know, I was a victim of romance novels, and so I didn't know she'd passed out. You know, and so I just thought this was just all way too glamorous, and so it was, I heard my dad talking to my mom, after the, party the next day. And he said, you know, Mrs. So-and-so, meaning this lady, is really a wonderful woman, but when she drinks too much, she becomes a bit of a floozy. I didn't know what that meant. It was about 3 months later, my father asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. I said, a floozy? And I'm here to tell you I achieved my goal. Add alcohol, instant floozy. So, you know, and the amazing part about that is Clancy, one of your people, Clancy has a tape called The Disease of Perception. And one of the things he talks about is how we perceive the world differently from other people. And I kept that image of that woman in my mind. And when I was 13 years old, my girlfriend and I got together, and we decided her parents were out of town, we were going to make ourselves a drink. You know, because I thought this was way too much fun. And I had sort of purloined this cigarette holder. My sponsor told me that purloined is a fancy word for theft, Cookie. Rats. And it was this ratty old cigarette holder somebody probably had thrown away. And then I had a cigarette that I found shortly before somebody lost it. And then I had, I decided to have my drink, you know. And so guess what I decided to make myself? Oh, you were listening. And so, yeah, I made myself a martini, and I poured myself a glass full of gin, because I said that there was no ice in a martini, and so I poured myself a glass full of warm gin. Good starter drink. And I drank that drink, and I'm going to tell you something. Before I took that drink, I like to talk about this a lot, because my entire career as a moderate drinker I can't even think of all the ones they have in the book, was from the time I picked up that drink. That was my social drinking until I put it to my lips. I was never a social drinker. I am one of those people that's instantly affected by ethyl alcohol, and I am beyond recall really fast. And so I picked up that drink, and I drank it, and I want to tell you something. In a matter of about 4 sips, I became that lady in that blue dress. And I was sophisticated, and I was beautiful, and I was charming, and I was everything you were supposed to be. Because somehow, in my world, as I grew up, and this message came from me, and I believe it's alcoholism, didn't come from my family. My head always said to me, you know, Cookie, you're really just not quite good enough. No matter how good you do, no matter how much you try, no matter how much you win, you're not just quite good enough. you know, and I had that eating on me all the time. And I'd work hard, and I'd try hard, and I'd train more than anybody else, and I'd do all that, and it was always back there saying, yeah, but you're just not tall enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not bright enough, you're not cute enough. You're just not enough. And so when I took that first drink, the magic happened for me. The magic happened. You know what? My brain shut up. And I didn't have to listen to that anymore. And I was free. I was free. God, I loved it. You know, I just loved it. I got to be free, you know? And all of a sudden, I didn't care if I was good at everything. I didn't care if I approved for everything. I didn't care about anything. You know, I just wanted to keep drinking because I wanted that feeling and I wanted that effect. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about alcoholics, from a doctor's opinion, it talks about that alcoholics drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. The effect is so elusive that after a while they cannot differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life is, to them, their is abnormal. Life becomes normal. And so what happened for me is I'm a super achiever little girl. And I go from being the super achiever little girl to all of a sudden being the head of the dropout party. I dropped out of high school. I stopped all my sports. I quit skating. I quit doing everything because all I wanted to do was drink. I'm one of those people that would give up anything to be able to keep drinking, and I did. I got married very young, and I started hanging around with the wrong people at the wrong times, doing the wrong things. And I want to talk about this because it's so important. It was important for me when I heard a woman do this, and I hung around those wrong people just once too often. And I had one of my friends' boyfriends follow me home one night, break into my house, and rape me. I talk about this because I want you to know something. I remember when I was first sober and somebody started talking about it, the woman talked about it from the podium, and I thought, don't you talk about that. Don't you say anything about that, because I didn't want to have to face thinking about it, you know. And I learned some things. I learned some things no human being should ever have to learn. I learned that if you're big enough and you're strong enough, you can do anything you damn well please to me, and there's nothing I can do about it. I learned that it doesn't matter what you believe or don't believe in this world, that somebody else can just take all that and ruin it in a few seconds. And in that moment, as a woman, I came from the right family. I did the right things. I was a little girl from the suburbs. You know, I got married at 19. You know, I was just didn't know from anything. And my world was shattered. I think about that now. The statistics for women alcoholics in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous suffering some form of abuse are over 85%. So I want you to know that if something like that has happened to you, I understand. And I want you to know that you're not alone. And I want you to know that I understand. And I want you to know that it is not your fault. Nobody, absolutely nobody, has the right to do anything to you, no matter what you said, no matter what you did, no matter what you wore, no matter what. No matter what. So please hear that and know that I stand on your side, as many women do. I threw myself away. Women will do that. I threw myself away. I didn't care anymore. I figured I was used goods, and I tried to commit suicide. I've always been bad at suicide, and obviously, but I tried to commit suicide because I thought I was damaged goods, and how was I ever going to tell anybody about any of this? There was just no way. And so I tried to commit suicide, and I woke up from that, and I thought, you know, alcoholics are great people. I just love us. I decided to rally. You know, I was going to whip out that willpower, slap it down on my alcoholism, and it's going to be fine. Going to be fine. Have you ever tried willpower on alcoholism? But I did that. I went down. I stopped drinking, and I came home every night after work, and I sat down in front of the TV, and I did needlepoint really fast. Just a little quick. And I did needlepoint, and I said, I'm not drinking. I'm not going to drink tonight. I'm not drinking tonight. I will not drink tonight. I am not drinking tonight. I am not going to drink tonight. I am not drinking tonight. I am not drinking tonight. I am not drinking tonight. Now, if you ever ask me if I have a problem with the second step in Alcoholics Anonymous, that's exactly what it sounds like. Because for me, when I'm not drinking, I'm thinking about drinking. And that is the nature of alcoholism from the doctor's opinion. You know, we have an illness that if we take any alcohol whatsoever into our bloodstream, we're going to want more. And when we're not drinking, we're thinking about the next time we can. So we are doomed, absolutely doomed. Hate to tell you that, but that's the news. And so So, you know, but I whipped out my willpower and I slapped it down on alcoholism and I didn't drink for 30 days. And at the end of 30 days, you know, it's an amazing thing. At the end of 30 days, I thought, well, I haven't had a drink for 30 days. Now, I didn't say, gee, I want to pick up a drink here and get raped again. You know, I didn't say that. I didn't say, I want to pick up a drink and throw myself away again. What I said is, I'm going to have a drink and this time it'll be different. Insanity? I know all about insanity. I picked up that drink and it was different. It got a lot worse. But I'm going to tell you something that's very hard to see. On one hand, I'm living a life that most people dream of. People look at me and they'd say, Cookie, you live like I dream. I had a yacht, I had a Ferrari, I had a Porsche, I had a jet. I had all the stuff you'd ever want. Very, very, very well off. Both my husband and I had done very well in business. And we traveled all over and we did fun stuff and we hang out with famous people and all those things. All those things. And they're just things. I had all the right jewelry and all the right clothes and all the right, you know, all out here. Always looking good, you know. And where was I? I hate it when I do that. Anyway, I'm old. So I picked up that drink and that drink picked me up. And I went out for another 10 years. And in that 10 years, I got gang raped. I got spit on. I got burned with cigarettes. And I got to meet the Prime Minister of England. Normal day. And so, but you know, the problem with that was that I didn't like me anymore. It was way beyond not liking me. I didn't even care anymore. I didn't care. I didn't care at all. You know, and if you would just drink with me for one night, if you'd just drink for me with one night, I'd sleep with you. I didn't care. You know, I just wanted attention. I wanted somebody to pay attention to me. Please don't leave me by myself, please. You know, and I'm an alcoholic and I'm dying of the illness. And in the end, I became a recluse because in the era that I grew up in, ladies don't get drunk. So when it started getting bad, I started staying home because I couldn't have my family. Have things said to my family. I couldn't do that. My family's very well known, and I wouldn't do that to them. So I started staying home. Women do a lot of at-home drinking because it's not acceptable for us to be out in my generation. So I did a lot of that at-home drinking, and I ended up being a knee-crawling drunk, dying of the illness of alcoholism, crawling across my $40,000 Persian carpet because my legs won't work anymore. I'm very, very large. I'm an attractive shade of yellow. I am dying of alcoholism. And I'd shinny myself up. I didn't know if my legs would work or not work. And I'd shinny myself up on the cabinet, and I'd get up to the sink, and I'd pour myself a glass of straight rum, and I'd try to drink it. And I'd throw it up, and I'd drink it, and I'd throw it up, and I'd drink it, and I'd throw it up. And maybe the fourth or the fifth or the sixth one would stay down. And then I would be okay. You know? And if you asked me if I had a problem with drinking, I would look right at you and say, I don't have a problem with drinking. I have a problem with being sober. Because life's just too hard, just too hard. I ended up trying to commit suicide because I'd had enough. And I said to the God that I had not talked to in an awful lot of years, God, if there is a God, please this time let me die. Don't make me do this anymore. Please. You know, and I ended up, my father showed up at my doorstep. He rang the doorbell. I'm like, you know how annoying it is when somebody interrupts your suicide plans? And I actually answered the door. That's the amazing part. My dad said, I want you to come home. I can't watch this anymore. I owe my father my life twice. I owe a lot of people my life. It's getting hard. Anyway, I went off, and my parents, like I said, are well-to-do. One of my father's friends owned a treatment facility, so I went. So I came out of that treatment facility, and I went to a meeting, and I could see very obviously that you had to jump into this thing. It's like being a member of a club. You have to just sort of do everything that they do, and pretty soon everybody will like you. So I got in, and I wanted to be the president of AA. And so I just did everything everybody did. And what I did was I would do anything you said and anything your sponsor said or anybody else's sponsor said. And the problem with that was in that era, there wasn't Big Book. So we had the steps on the wall, and we had the traditions on the wall, and I just took off, and I can read on the wall. You know, and that's what I did. I did the steps off the wall. You know, I lost 100 pounds. I had a facelift, and I looked gorgeous. And guys would look at me that wouldn't look at me when I was heavy, and they'd say, "Boy, I'd love to go out with you." And I said, "If you think I'm going to date you when I'm thin, why would I want to date you when I was fat?" And I was just mean. Anyway, so I went along like that, you know, and I didn't, my sponsor didn't tell me to do anything else. And one day I'm listening to a speaker, sort of like you're sitting here right now listening to me. And that speaker decided not to tell his story. And he told about the history of AA. And he talked about Sister Ignatia and Father Dowling. And he talked about the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts of world service. And he talked about all these things in our historical background. And I remember looking there, and I didn't know any of them. I didn't know anything he was talking about, you know. And I remember getting in my car, and I put the key in my ignition, and I said, Cookie, you call yourself a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you don't even know what you're a member of. You're a hypocrite. This is a bad thing to be in Cookie Land. I was home that night. And I was trying to figure out a way to kill myself. I'm 3.5 years sober, stone cold sober, sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, going to 3 meetings a week, sponsoring people. God knows what message I was carrying. And I'm dying of alcoholism. Because alcoholism doesn't necessarily mean drinking, does it? Ism, the way I think. It was never addressed. All of a sudden something happened. I was reading an issue of The Grapevine, our meeting in print. And it said that you will come a time in your sobriety, there will come a time in your sobriety when a piece of your ego, that's how you define yourself, is dying off because it is no longer necessary and it's trying to take you with it. I labeled that piece Cookie the Star because it tried to kill me. Because I was going to do all the things so that you would love me. And I still hated me. You know, and this is an inside job, not an outside job. I surrendered to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a message in my head that said, you better read the big book like your life depends on it, because it does. Trust me, I didn't say that. And I started reading the book, and I started from the very beginning, and it said, we of Alcoholics Anonymous, more than 100 men and women who have recovered, past tense, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, show the alcoholics precisely how we covered is the main purpose of this book. That's what it's for. I thought it was an end table ornament. And I took off, man. I was excited. I started doing this stuff, and every time a new girl would show up, I'd grab her and I'd go, hi, my name's Cookie, and you're really going to love this program. We're going to go together like this, and you're really going to love this, and it'll really be fun. And I got every woman that came in new, and I started working with people, and I was a terror. And we'd come in like everyone, and we'd sit, and we'd take up all 3-4 rows, and there'd be their sponsees and their sponsees, and all the guys would come along, and they'd go, oh, there's that Cookie again. There's that Cookie without, and I never wouldn't let the girls date, because I told them I didn't date for a year and a half, so it's only a suggestion. And so they didn't date, and so all the men hated me because I had all the beautiful sponsees. And I got lots of amends over the years from guys for that. Anyway, so and then they go, oh, here comes Cookie and Oliver Crumbs. So one of my girls, typical of my line of sponsorship, we're all a little crazy, she goes, I'm Cookie's Crumb! So that wrecked it for them. Anyway, so we had Cookie and her Crumbs, and I did that until I was 7 years sober, almost 8 years sober, and ego reasserted itself, as it will always do. And when it reasserted itself, I did got into some behavior that was really not nice. And it was old behavior, and I embarrassed myself. And I wasn't, people were not real proud of me. And I had to surrender this program one more time. Because for me, drinking is never an option. Suicide's always my option. Drinking's just not an option for me. So the one thing I have learned through all of this is I did another surrender, and I've done a bunch of surrenders since then. I have had 5 years of absolute hell in my life these last 5 years. Between the cancer and a divorce and all kinds of stuff, it's just been awful. And so that's all I can say. I mean, I could dance and, you know, dress it up for you, but that's the truth of the matter. And my standing here sober is such a gift from a God that I have come to understand it a little bit better. And here's what I'm going to say to you, if you're new, if you're old, if you're anything. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that nothing so much ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when all other measures fail. My life has fallen apart in great big fat hunks. And I'm working with my girls, and I'm doing what I got to do to stay sober. If you think that you came in here to save your butt, I am here to disillusion you of that. You're here, and your sobriety is a gift, and that gift must be repaid, or you will not stay sober. I will guarantee that. We have a fellowship here, and we have a Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous and a program of recovery, and it needs to be followed and passed on to the next guy. You got your chance. You are sober today because somebody took that time. Somebody took that time to read the book to you, to take you through the steps, to do that. If you don't in turn turn and do that, I will guarantee you will not stay here. I'll just guarantee it. I've watched it for a lot of years now. I've watched the winners and I've watched the losers, and it never changes. The winners are always busy working with somebody, and the losers are always the ones saying the meeting's too long and I don't like this and this is crummy and they're not working with anybody. They're not with the newcomers. They're not doing anything. My relationship with God today is so beyond anything I could possibly put into words for you because of the things that have happened to me and the love that has been shown to me that it is unbelievable. And what I want to say also is that if you have one hand in your sponsor's hand and one hand reaching back to the person who's coming along, you are in a very long line of people that go all the way back to the beginning. And you also have no hands to pick up a drink. So I want to thank you for allowing me to be your speaker this evening. I want to thank you more and more from my heart every day that I have been blessed with my sobriety, with my life. I just got 3 years clean from cancer. And yeah, it's a cool deal. And And I want you to know that I am not special, that I haven't been particularly blessed, but what I have always known is that my home is here. So if you're new, welcome home. If you're coming back, welcome home. And if you're an old-timer, please stay home. I need you. Thank you for my life.